Seems to be a drop-off, abrupt drop-off there.
Yes, that's sort of a gross little dirt particles built up in the volume control. Things that we have to change with the proper amount of funding. We could replace these dirty controls with clean ones.
You mean something from the National Endowment for the Clean Particulate Matter?
No, not from the Clean Pickpocket Matter, but rather from the pockets of our listener.
Who might that be?
That's correct, and that's what we want to find out today. We're here, and before we go to today's impressive tale, we'll just give you the phone number because you can pledge to the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar and its wonderful umbrella, its keeper of the rain off the microphones, its washer of the particulates from the volume controls, WGDR here in Plainfield, Vermont. 454-7762 or 454-1238. Calvos and Damien about to begin our third year on the air, bringing you contemporary, unusual compositions of various kinds. One of the few shows in the country, and the only show of its kind on the internet. So, I'll just fade away into my particulate drop-off and listen.
You may be needed, though, at one point.
Oh, I'll be here.
Although smallpox was officially eradicated 28 and a half years ago by the World Health Organization, tinypox was not. And no matter it painfully offed 40% of those it infected, the smallpox virus was a pleasant romp on the beach on a warm summer's day compared to the utterly nasty tinypox. A scourge so vile that even its offspring keeps its viral distance. Fortunately, tinypox is difficult to transmit. Radical rectilinear motion by fluid mechanics, coupled with the ingestion of pantophobic fungi from Samoa, are required. A combination uncommon since the 1980s.
Isn't the 1980s when we got computer-controlled, computer-aided design?
Shh.
So we didn't... I'm just thinking ahead.
So you are. One place where they both are openly practiced still, however, is at a militant music camp high in the foothills of Middle America, an armed fortress known to FBI informants and their accountants as the Skull of Mantovani.
Oh, I know the place. I have seen their website. I have been near there.
Near in a computer?
No, I have passed right by. The Skull of Mantovani.
Named after their leader, a formerly complacent orchestra conductor and kettle drum smuggler, the Skull of Mantovani is comprised of a wide variety of musical malcontents, from bellicose community band librarians to oboe workshop administrators, from hair stylist quartet dropouts to French horn mouthpiece smiths, from psychotic violists, a redundancy.
Yeah, I was going to say, no other kind.
To unemployed copyists unable or unwilling to learn cutting-edge computer music technology necessary for contemporary score design. They must number in the thousands.
In the decades.
Oh, right. The precise number of adherents is unknown. Estimates range from 34 to 12,381, including some members of Congress. The Skull's manifesto is but 2 pages long and reads like an amalgam of Karl Marx, St. Thomas Aquinas, and Porky Pig. It rails against the sinisterly obfuscating dynamics of a concert No. Skipped a line. Doesn't make sense.
Yeah, doesn't make sense. I didn't anyway.
Didn't make anyway? Wait a minute. This is carefully cultivated text here.
I was still back with the unknown number of adhesives.
Right.
And amalgams.
Amalgams, adhesive amalgamated, right.
Malcolm Montavani.
The precise number, I did that.
But we needed to go back there. The precise number of adhesives.
Adhesatives is unknown. The Skull's Manifesto is but 2 pages long and reads like an amalgam of Karl Marx, St. Thomas Aquinas, and Porky Pig. It rails against the sinisterly obfuscating pronouncement of ASCAP, BMI, and Publishers Clearinghouse, yet embraces the dynamics of a concert of Mahler's Reformation Symphony in the Liberace Museum in Las Vegas. During one such performance in 1980, the tinypox virus was first unleashed onto an unsuspecting audience by a forerunner to the Skull of Montavani, Herb Alpert's Craniacs.
Oh, gosh. I remember them, too. This is all familiar territory for me.
And wasn't the Craniac an early
computer? Yes, it was. It was a very early computer. Yes, it used, as a matter of fact, it used vacuum skulls.
As the lugubrious third movement, i.e. of the Mahler Reformation Symphony, number 2, was drawing to an umpteenth recapitulation, the Craniacs, masquerading as modern dancers in the Martha Stewart Graham mold, began to sashay down the aisles, struggling to approximate a radical rectilinear motion while ducking the dozens of chandeliers in the auditorium, which were swaying back and forth in approximate time to the music. Extracting from their pantaloon pockets biscuits infused with Samoan pantophobic fungi, the agitators tossed them to the spectators, who, conversant with Vegas-style entertainment, eagerly gobbled them. By the time the batonster had rung every last note from the movement, the tinypox virus had squeezed every last breath from the audience. The fourth, fifth, and optional seventh movements were thus played without interruption or scrutiny, a practice observed in many dinner theaters to this day. The perpetrators were, I'm sure you're wondering where this is going.
I am.
I'm following
with very, very carefully wrapped attention, especially about those pantophobic fungi, which I still haven't had a chance to discuss.
From Samoa.
Yes.
The perpetrators were eventually caught and sentenced to be shot out of a cannon into the sun. The sole survivor, who fell into the sea, some 92...
Sole survivor. Ow. Ouch.
Okay, go ahead.
Sole survivor. Some 92.9 million miles short of the target, reportedly changed his name to He Who Tastes Lousy to Sharks, or Le Flambeau Orange. He's still out there. Somewhere. And we're in here somewhere, we being Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, this portion of which is nearing the penultimate development section, having passed the first false coda a minute ago, and somewhere being the beseechment booth at famous needy radiophonic emporium WGDR 91.1, both in FM numbers and the amount of pledge dollars necessary to keep the following 1 hour, 50 minutes, 48-minute slot of music and words from turning nasty and unleashing its own musical virus on an unsuspecting or suspecting or suspicious public. So give heartily, as I give you with no questions asked or answered. Calvasiusk.
Oh, indeed. Pantophobic fungi from Samoa. That's why I was thinking that they had to be sort of squeezed out because we don't use those pantographs anymore. We use computer monitors now to do our design. That's what I was getting at, that there was another subtext to what you were saying.
Of course.
Yes, okay. And speaking of subtext, you notice how my voice just did that?
Subtextually.
Yes. Although I forgot to bring the tape, and someday I will, there's someone who interviews with that sound to her voice, and that's on a public radio station somewhere, someone by the name of Terry Gross. You know, we were interviewed by Terry 21 years ago, tomorrow.
Tomorrow, just
so
think.
Perhaps we could give a copy of that as a premium for someone who calls up on 454-7762.
This was before she learned her NPR accent and was still in the throes of Brooklyn and Buffalo.
And chain-smoking.
That too.
454-1238 is your other option. We're listening to Reese Chatham, and today's show, the Pop Rocks Pox, part one, we'll explore the use of various popular forms, haha, so to speak, in what we call concert music. And you're listening to Reese Chatham's piece, An Angel Moves Too Fast to See, and we'll hear the last minute of that before coming back to annoy you some more.
The audience thought it was over sooner than it was, too, we did.
Those are those, what were you talking, you were talking about those sorts of endings in your essay.
I was?
You were. You were talking about them. Unexpected things, the Skull of Mantovani. That was Reese Chatham's An Angel Moves Too Fast to See, played by Les 100 Guitars, the 100 Guitars. So
C-A-T-A-R-R-H?
Probably, especially since this is the rock spot, rock, I can't say it, the Pop Rocks Pox
Pop
show.
Pop Rocks Pox, yes.
Yes. Let's just move right along, giving that phone number, and if you're calling from out of state or listening to the show on the internet, the area code is 802. The number is 454-7762. We have lots of premiums. You've heard them read during the day. We have a couple of special ones that you can only get on the Calvis and Damien show. We have an LP by Fred Ho, who gave a live concert last year here with us. This is a song for Menang, the soundtrack of a film, and it's brand new, all shiny, and with its plastic on it. And we have two copies. We'll play you from these later. Two copies of Chris Koenigsberg's CD, Brains. You can't get it from anywhere but here or from Chris Koenigsberg himself. The most hated compact disc in the history of our program. You can get it here, 454-7762, 454-1238.
Do we have a price on those yet? Or a bounty, as it were?
Oh, well, yeah. You can get one of these. I think we should probably keep the tradition that you have to give at least $10 to pledge at least $10 to get one of these.
And then another 10 to give it back.
Yeah, yes. No, 15 to give it back.
I guess that makes sense.
Again, Calvis and Damien, beginning next week, our third year on the air. We would love to hear from you. Love to, even if you're not going to pledge something, give us a call, because we'll try to talk you into it when you do call. Because it's a particularly unusual set of premiums, and of course, as we said, and we're not kidding for a change, this is one of the few programs of this sort of music in the United States, and currently the only one that you could hear on the internet of this sort of concert and concert influenced music. We have also a one of a kind premium as well.
A handmade stoneware square plate measuring 8 1/2 inches on a side. Some of the other sides are a little more, a little less. It is handmade after all, with colorfully painted, somewhat loony cartoon faces that you won't see anywhere else, from Susan Hajdusek, a potter in Moscow, i.e. Moscow, Vermont, not the former Soviet Union, and it can be yours today or tomorrow for a pledge of only $59.95. Similar cartoon plates, each is a one-of-a-kind piece. There are no duplicates. Retail for upwards of $75 in Moscow, i.e. Moscow, the former Soviet Union, not Vermont. So this is a really swell deal. 454-7762, 454-1238 to resign your one-of-a-kind cartoon plate. To
resign.
Resign. Yes, you're giving up your money for this plate.
Excellent. One more time, 802-454-7762, 802-454-1238. Let Callus and Damien hear from you, and let's turn to James Tenney, one of the early examples of crossing the idioms. What's the plural of that anyway? Idioms, idia.
Idiots.
I don't know.
James Tenney, golf course. We didn't bring that, did we?
We didn't do that, I'm afraid. Collage number one called Blue Suede from 1961 by James Tenney. 3 minutes of exploration in tape and... Oh, and related media. Suede. That's music by James Tenney from 1961. First experiments in crossing some of those media. This is the Pop Rocks Pox show of the Calvus and Damien New Music Bazaar, the one in which we ask you to support us, to provide us not with
Athletic support?
Not, I was going to say, not with undergarments, but with underwriting.
You can wear underwriting as well. Wear
probably
it on the
can.
Wall.
Probably can. Well, 454-7762, 454-1238.
Yeah?
Those are the phone numbers. Those are the numbers to call to pledge. And while we're getting ready for, today's interview, yes, Dr. Nerve, Nick Didkovsky, will be here at 3 o'clock. Nick Didkovsky is playing. He's the with Dr. Nerve, his ensemble, featured at the Victoriaville Festival on Monday. The festival is on right now, on Monday, May 19th, Dr. Nerve at 7 p.m., and the Sirius String Quartet will be performing at the Victoriaville Festival. And if you don't know where that is, just go to Montreal and turn right. Keep going.
Unless you're coming from, if you're coming from the west.
From Hudson Bay, yeah, turn left. If you're coming from, say, Toronto, just keep going straight. And go about another hour and you'll be in Victoriaville. Anyway, we can give you more details on it as you call us to pledge at 454-7762 or 454-1238. We'll tell you more about the Victoriaville Festival and Dr. Nerve. In the meantime, another experimenter in crossing forms is John Zorn.
Oh, him, yes.
And we'll just play a little bit of a piece called Spillane. We haven't played Spillane on the show for about a year and a half. So
I don't see it anywhere.
It's spilling right over here. Yes,
fine.
It's here. So here it is, a little bit of John Zorn while we wait for your calls. You can just imitate what you hear.
this long to talk to your hand, Cigarette would burn my three fingers. I feel like I just smoked a deck of cigarettes and forgot to blow out the smoke.
Yes, John Zorn being just lovely, pretentious.
Think so?
Yeah, well, of course. He enjoys that sort of thing. But you have something better.
I do? Ah, yes. Possibly.
Yes, just before we go to the interview with Nick Ditkovsky at 3 o'clock, you have another example of crossing something or other.
And speaking of crossing, I have not yet crossed the bridge to put the stylus down on the groove. It is hanging up.
Stylus? This is a long-playing vinyl?
Only the best for this listening audience. This is a piece we played 2 years ago, less perhaps a month. The
yes.
only time it's been played, perhaps on.
And it got phone calls. People like this.
Someone
piece.
Liked this. Yeah. Yes, it's by a now defunct group from Italy called Piccio del Pozzo, and the tune is called Uccellin del Bosco, which is Italian for Uccellin del Bosco.
Bosco birds. I don't know what's a bosco.
And this has an interesting alignment of personnel. It's recorded in Geneva in 1981. Piccio del Pozzo.
That's not quite it.
That's not quite it.
No, it sounds interesting. Maybe that's the end of... Oh, here it is. Yes, a group of Italians no longer in existence, recorded in Geneva in 1981.
Uccellin del Bosco by, what is it, Piccio del... that so?
I suppose so. Oh. Over WGDR Plainfield, asking for your dollars, pledges of support, and any other hanky-panky you'd like to throw in.
Absolutely. And we just have to be serious here.
Oh,
I don't know how. I don't know how. This particular program would love to hear from you. We know we have listeners out there. We regularly do get phone calls. This is probably the one time we don't get as many as we usually do, because we're asking for you to say, yes, we love that show so much. We love your insulting behavior. We love your slurs and bad everything that you do, including your music, so much we're going to give you money.
People can call and not necessarily need to pledge if they feel the urge to call regardless. We'll accept any call at all.
Yes, we will. 454-7762.
However, we do have a tracer on our telephone which will allow us to find out who you are even if you don't give your name. And someday in the mail you will receive a debit notice. Thank you.
Okay, 454-1238. Call us on either line. We're going to go now to New York City and an interview with Nick Didkovsky. We're not going to interrupt the interview with the pledge break, except right after we hear each piece of music. So,
that's cheap.
I know it is, but we just don't want to. What can I tell you?
Don't break the mold.
Don't break anything. New York City, Nick Didkovsky.
I understand that the room in which we are seated is historically important. Not only is it a famous recording studio, but it is the location in which L. Ron Hubbard started his Dianetics. Yes.
You understand that they are engaging in a large lawsuit now.
I didn't know they were engaged. I thought they had broken off and were just going their separate ways. I thought it was just not going to work.
And how did you understand that this room was that historic place?
Because of all the vinyl in it. And naturally, I immediately thought of nothing else in particular. Just that there's just an aura in this room. And the R is shared by Calvos and Damien on the New Music Bazaar, BUZZARE. It's a new spelling for this particular venture into New York. And the redoubtable Dr. Nerve.
The head nerve.
The neuron
of Dr. Nerve.
The nerve center.
Nick Didkovsky. Welcome to the bazaar.
Well, thank you. And likewise. Go for a little more aura here.
Oh, a little more aura. Wonderful. Well, we should explain right away that the other ambient quality of the room is the sound of a historic computer item that is humming and the disc rattling and the fan going mad trying to keep it cool because of its, no doubt, its age and... Please.
Importance,
yeah. It's made in Mexico City, the Amigo.
The Amigo, yes.
Sorry, well, this is the female version called the Amiga. And, I would love to get a hold of another one and just, like, shrink wrap it so I'll have it, you know, available for parts for the next, you know, 20 years of my life. So you can't find these. It's getting to be a very scarce beast.
Well, and this will lead really into a lot of the things we've got to talk about, because some of the work you've done has been in HMSL, which is one of the granddaddy great computer languages for creating music.
Yeah, it's even more obscure than the Amiga.
Yeah.
I tend to find smaller and smaller communities to belong to and isolate myself from as many people as possible. So, of course, you know, I didn't want to buy an IBM PC clone or a Macintosh. I bought an Amiga, and, of course, I didn't want to write in C or Pascal. I wanted to write in Forth, you know, and couldn't use some big, wonderful batch music program. I had to use something that's, you know, instantly hard to learn and that you have to, you know, read manuals for months before you even hear your first bleep. So I succeeded in completely isolating myself from the general community.
Well, it's to compensate for the fact that you have guitars here.
That's right.
That's right.
It's polar opposites. There you go.
Well, welcome to the show, and what I'm going to start out by an admission, because when I was in Holland in 91, 92, you played at the Bim House.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And there was Louis Anderson in the front row enjoying it enormously, and I was in the back row saying, "This sounds derivative! This sounds derivative!" I was sitting there and I was being very unhappy about this, and I went back home and I wrote a journal of my experiences that I published in the Vermont Composer's Newsletter, and I said, "I heard this band and it sounds like Warmed Over John Truby." And that's when Larry Polanski contacted me after reading that, and I've been in touch with Larry about other things, and said, "You have to meet Nick Ditkovsky because he's the leader of Dr. Nerve," and he gave a talk at Rensselaer about John Truby. I said,
"Incredible!"
Anyway, so
wow,
that was my first hearing of your stuff, and David has another history of hearing stuff on another.
I do. Remind me.
Well, you went and bought a bunch of LPs.
Oh, those, yes, old Dr. Nerves again from the mail order outlet in Wheaton, Maryland.
Wayside,
yeah,
through Wayside.
Well, then it would have been that Wayside is the distribution arm, and Cuneiform is the label.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we came on here entirely different. So you have an incredibly deep history of all kinds of stuff. So you start at sort of the beginning and wend us through for a while.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess the most pertinent beginning of compositional work was in electronic music and tape music. My parents gave me a tape recorder when I was, I don't know, maybe like 8 or 9 years old. And it was a little reel-to-reel tape recorder, and you could remove this little spindle to make it go, you know,
a little Iowa, slower, one of those,
faster. It was excellent.
Those?
And they didn't, you know, the marketing department.
And
I guess
you screwed it down. You screwed the extra spindle in the middle up top.
Yeah.
To save it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And this thing was called a sound camera because the marketing department, I guess, didn't want to call it a tape recorder. People wouldn't know what it was. So they called it a sound camera. It was excellent. It's a wonderful little thing, the kind of thing that, you know, burns up on, Mission Impossible after you hear like 2-10 seconds of it. And discovered how to thread the tape so it goes backwards. And I remember really early sort of phoneme exercises with my dad where we would write out words phonetically and kind of figure out how they would sound backwards, and we'd record them backwards and play them forwards and see if we could talk backwards and make it sound forwards. And, like, really, you know, getting into this sort of object of a sound, you know, and like, the manipulation of what happens to sound when you actually put it in a fixed medium, and a medium that you can start manipulating. So that's kind of like a little seed. And I was also learning how to play folk guitar because my mother was very interested in folk guitar. She was taking the Laura Weber course on Channel 13, Folk Guitar with Laura Weber. And I kind of followed her lead. And so there were kind of these two parallels in my life. You know, I didn't really put them together at that time, but I was very interested in this kind of weird sound manipulation device. And I was interested in, you know, the A major chord and the E major chord, too. And much later at Brown, where I studied as an undergraduate, I took some electronic music courses and started to get, you know, heavily into tape splicing and sound manipulation and collage and so on. And also, you know, in a parallel track, also being very interested in listening to, you know, a bunch of different music, you know, heavy metal, and I was really heavily into King Crimson at the time, Frank Zappa, and Bartok, and, you know, it's kind of like getting turned on to a lot of different things, Art Bears, you know, Fred Frith, and having this 8-track studio on campus that I was actually, you know, taking a course in. And I think my composition has been my composition for live musicians has been very, very influenced by my tape work, just through the ability of splicing, you know, making rapid, instantaneous changes. And the kinds of things that I would do, going from one very defined texture to another radically different kind of texture on tape, was something that I didn't deliberately set out to do with a band, but ended up kind of being in there. So I was so used to hearing that kind of pacing. It was a very natural thing for me to hear, so it was kind of a natural thing for me to start putting into music. And After college, I spent a year in New York City and took in, you know, as much as I possibly could. Went to the kitchen every night, mm-hmm. went to the Experimental Intermediate Foundation every night, just to, like, help them set up chairs or something. You know, I would just, like, get into all the shows free and kind of help around, you know, help around the space. And after that, I went up to the Creative Music Studio, where I'd say the biggest kind of quantum leap in sort of discovering where I could go with music and composition and improvisation and performance and the electric guitar and, you know, tape and noise and all that kind of thing, really started to, like, come together in a really interesting way. Because there'd be, you know, like 20 students from all over the world, each with their own very strong field of talent, specialties, interests, and you would put these bands together, you know, with, like, a guitarist from Italy and a drummer from Ghana, yeah. and, you know, a vocalist from, you know, Arkansas or whatever. It's just, like, crazy place. In fact, we used to call it Crazy Music School, CMS, which was the acronym. Of course, it was called Creative Music Studio, but CMS could stand for other things. And that's where the first kind of prototype of Dr. Nerve discovered itself. I had a really powerful experience in a composition class taught by Keita Carroll and Dave Holland. A lot of very, very intense musicians that would come through that place and do workshops. Paulina Oliveros was there. James, the guitarist, string trio.
We're all blanking.
Yeah, I keep thinking of James Tenney, but it's not James Tenney. James Tenney's not a guitarist. Oh, I'll come back to him.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Baikita and Dave did this composition class and gave very, very simple assignment. Just write two musical lines that go together. And I think I spent all night, you know, with my guitar and a tape recorder, like, playing one line down, editing it, listening to it, changing it, and then, like, adding and playing another one against it, and thinking about it and changing it, messing around with it. I finally came up with something that I thought was pretty hot. You know, I really wanted to hear this, but it was just literally two lines of music, like two bars. I brought it into class the next day, and it was a huge class. It's like 20 people. You know, two drummers, two electric bass players, a couple guitars, a lot of horns, you know. And they started to play it, and it was like really like a square wheel at first, like, you know, just tortured kind of warty thing trying to get off the ground. And after like 5 minutes, and it was so repetitive, you know, people finally found their way into it, and I don't know, they must have played it for like a half hour, yeah. And you know, after 10 minutes, the room just exploded. The sound was unbelievable. You know, it was like 20 people just blowing their brains out on this riff. And, you know, Dave Holland was, like, playing the bass and just had this big smile on, you know, and Baikita was playing his horn and started to improvise over the top of it. And I was just like, I wasn't even playing. I was just conducting at first. Yeah. And then after a while, I had nothing to do. So I would just, like, run around the room, you know, going from instrument to instrument, just, you know, how does it sound over here? You know, how does it sound over here? You know, stand right behind the drummer. It's like, my God, listen to the groove, you know. And that electric sound, there's a lot of electric instruments, and this, like, very heavy, heavy, heavy kind of rock beat thing with horns and jazz improvisation and this interlocking. It was a hard lick, you know, it was kind of tricky. It kind of come together in certain places and kind of drift off in certain places and just came, you know, give you this really powerful unity thing. And that made an extraordinary impression on me. It was a very, very, very powerful experience. And it kind of set the, planted the seed, I think, for a sound that was going to be Dr. Nerve.
Dense. Yeah. It pushes, it's really drives ahead all the time. It's nonstop driving ahead.
Yeah. That's what this did. That riff, by the way, is at the end of, Not Everyone's as Rich as Your Parents, which is off of Armed Observation. So that riff just, like, hung around for years, and I found it, you know, ended up writing it into a piece. So So that was a big, you know, kick in the head. And then there was a band that formed just for like one or two student concerts. And we called that band Spy Boy.
Spy Boy.
Yeah, which was a tune, which became a tune, and was really the first tune that I wrote for a band that would eventually sound like Dr. Nerve. That's on the first record.
Now, what year are we talking about with this?
This is like 1982.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, 82. Like spring of 82, summer of 82, right in that area.
Do you want to pause to play that excerpt? We do have.
Yeah, I think, yeah, let's do that. It's from Armed Observation. The name of the tune is, again?
Spy Boy.
Spy Boy. One of the early tunes, Spy Boy, Nick Didkovsky, from what year, Armed Observation?
Oh, boy.
Well, never mind. Not this year.
85?
85,
right.
87?
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah. Actually, Spy Boy's off of Autobahn Fresh Kings. The riff that we were talking about is in Not Everyone's As Rich As Your Parents, which is off Armed Observation. Okay.
Which is what we played, since that's the LP that we have handy.
That's what we have right now.
We knew that.
Yeah. We knew that.
Right.
We'll fix it. So, all right, so back to the tale, because what we want to sort of get to is how you end up doing programming to achieve your goals.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, just find out where that comes
from. Yeah, okay. Well, there was a period after the Creative Music Studio when I lived in Woodstock, and shared an apartment with Yves Dubois, soprano sax player from America. And the band at that point was called Defense Spending. And we've got four tunes that we recorded in Brian Farmer, the drummer's living room, onto this four track here, which is underneath the
bags
cat box
of clothing and a cat box.
Great machine, four track Scully half inch tape. You really crank it up; it just sounds gorgeous.
It looks like a real recording machine.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful unit. It
gives you confidence in your own work.
I'll never get rid of it. So, and that was an amazing session. We recorded like all three horns onto one track, you know, live, no overdubs, no nothing. Guitar and violin onto another one, bass on its own track, all the drums onto its own track. It was insane. So anyway, that was going on for about a year, and then I went to Germany for the summer, played with some interesting people in a group called Anima Musica. When I came back, Eve had decided to move back to New York City, and I stayed around Woodstock for a little while. Defense Spending broke up. I was in a couple of other bands. And then I got a call from Jim Musson, who I met at the Creative Music Studio, who's living in New York City. And he invited me down for just some informal playing. And I would go down like every other weekend in my $400 Chevy Nova. And that's where I met Mark Wagnon, the Vibes player. And that's where I met Mike Leslie, the original bassist. And Don Davis. I gave Michael Lytle a call because I wanted a sax player. And I had a nice long conversation for about an hour with Michael. I never spoke to him before, you know, and at the end he says, "No, I'd love to come down and play with you guys, but who told you I played sax?" I said, "Well, what do you play?" He says, "Well, I play bass clarinet." I said, "Oh, that's cool. Yeah, come on. No problem." So I can empathize
with that instrument. That was my first one.
Oh, yeah?
Bass clarinet. I took it home every day, and my parents made me shut the door.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you bet.
Okay, you sit in with us anytime you want. So that was like an early version of the band, and it was called Lethal Injection for a while, and then I wrote a tune called Dr. Nerve, and we liked the name of the tune so much that we ended up calling the band Dr. Nerve. And you know, like, and that would function. You know, we put out the first record at Chuck Vertasik's prodding. He told me to compile a cassette of the existing recordings, send it around to a few distributors, tell them you're going to make a record. How many could they possibly move for you? And if they all say, if it X is above some number, do it, make a record. So Chuck, I really, thank him a lot for his persistence. He's really telling me to get the music out. And and Wayside was extremely enthusiastic about the cassette, so I put out the first record. Then the second record was put out by Cuneiform, which was the label arm of Wayside Music, so that was called Armed Observation. In the meantime, I was getting very interested in a particular structure, like a social game that falls under a prisoner's dilemma game theory. And it was it's a particular kind of lottery that
you want to explain the prisoner's dilemma.
The prisoner's dilemma idea is that you've got a society, either a very small society or a very large society, it's really irrelevant, of individuals not in communication with each other that are making decisions that are either cooperative decisions or defecting decisions. And the way the game, the balance in the game is that if everyone cooperated, everyone would benefit maximally. If everyone defected, everyone would benefit minimally. But unfortunately, and that's where the twist is, in a large group of cooperators, a small group of defectors do extremely well. So it's like being in a community and everyone kind of has a choice of locking their doors or not locking their doors. Everyone cooperates, leaves their doors unlocked, and everyone benefits maximally. It's like, great, you know, we've got freedom. I don't have to worry about the keys. If I feel good, you know, I can come in and out, go as I please. But a defector is going to do extremely well. A defector will go into your apartment and take what he wants and leave. So that's, you know, a very simple version of the game, which is not very mathematical. You can really quantify this thing. Like, the reason called Prisoner's Dilemma is that you have two prisoners in isolation in two cells. If they rat on each other, they both get, I don't know, let's say 4 years. If one guy rats and the other guy stays quiet, the guy that rats only gets 2 years. The guy that stays quiet gets 5. And if they both stayed quiet, they would both get 2. So it'd be coolest for both of them if they both just stayed cool and didn't say anything. They'd each get out in 2 years. But there's this incredible temptation to rat on the other guy, hoping he's going to be nice, you know, because I'll get out in 1 and screw him, you know. But of course, there's no reason to think that the other guy isn't going to do the exact same thing. So kind of what happens is that this kind of this tendency toward defection, and that's like the single, this is the most overriding difficult problem in Prisoner's Dilemmas. And it was studied very, very heavily by a lot of very smart people, like the Rand Corporation, because there's all sorts of, you know, like military overtones. It's like, do you first strike or not? You know, okay, we'll both promise not to. You know, really? Yeah, I'm not gonna, you know, I'm gonna send a bomb. I promise. You gonna cooperate? Yeah, sure. The tension is so incredible. Yeah, that's what a cold. It's like arms escalation. It's all about. And, you know, of course, everyone will benefit maximally if no one sends a bomb. And, you know, in a very primitive reptilian way, an aggressor will benefit by defecting against a cooperator, because you'll blow them to smithereens and, you know, rule the world or something obscene like that. And if they both defect, there's no more Earth, you know. So like, that's a pretty quantified prisoner's dilemma theory. So anyway, I was really, like, interested in these kinds of processes, and I really rejected the typical metaphors of... I was interested in the mathematical process and the social responsibility aspects of it, and, you know, people getting along or not getting along and interdepending on each other or not. But I really wanted to remove it from the typical realms of money or, you know, years spent in jail or, you know, first strike nuclear attacks. And I wanted to do it somehow with music. So I wrote a letter to Pauline Oliveros telling her about my idea. And this particular Prisoner's Dilemma was constructed by Douglas Hofstetter in an article in Scientific American called Alluring Lottery. And it's a beautiful, beautiful construction. He offered $1 million prize to the winner of the lottery, and it was open to any of the readers of his article. So, you know, potential audience of millions of readers. And it was $1 million prize. I think he even got it insured. There was no cost to entering ballots into the lottery, as opposed to a lotto or whatever, where each ballot costs $1. That's a natural check on how many times you're going to enter into a lottery, because you're not going to risk $2,000 to win. You're going to spend maybe $2 or $1. But in the Luring Lottery, there is no limit to the number of ballots you can enter, because there's no cost. He said, in fact, don't even send in ballots. Just send in a postcard with a number on it representing how many ballots you would like to enter into the lottery. And then we'll pick one of the ballots. You know, I'll write some computer program that'll just randomly say, okay, Jim sent in 10,000 ballots. You know, so-and-so sent in 20. So-and-so sent in 1 million. And, you know, we'll juggle the numbers and we'll pick a winner, and the winner will get a prize. But the prize, which is the beautiful twist, is divided by the total number of ballots submitted by everybody.
I see.
There's an inverse relationship between greed and reward.
Yes.
Which is magnificent.
That's great.
So if we three were playing, and we all wanted to be good, you know, to each other, we might either decide to not enter at all or enter one ballot. So let's say we all enter one. Whoever wins, and some even chance of winning, is going to get one-third of $1 million, because the total sum, the sum was 3 divided into $1 million, goes to the winner. But then, of course, you're going to be a little tempted. It's like, maybe I should, you know, put in 10 ballots, because I'll probably put in one. I get 10-to-1 chance of winning. You know, thinking, of course, you're the only one in the whole society who ever came up with that genius idea, you know. Meanwhile, everyone else is thinking, like, maybe I'll put in 1,000, you know, or maybe I'll put in 10,000, or I'll put in 1,000,000. You know, everyone else is bound to vote low. And what happened, of course, was that people wrote in values on cards that, like, defied mathematical computation of how enormous, you know, these numbers would be, like mathematical constructions of things being raised to the power of, to the power of, to the power of some number, you know. And it was absolutely impossible to calculate who would have won. And in Hofstetter's words, the prize would have been so close to zero that God himself wouldn't have known the difference. We pause for a second and hear.
Yeah, this is true. We'll listen to something. What are we?
We'll listen to a dial tone.
Yeah, we'll put on something.
Oh, it's my my phone came back. Oh, great. That was nice.
Your phone out for a while, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was out this evening. This happens to me like every month. 9X screws me.
Well, let's pause this anyway and listen to some music. Okay, here we go. Some music by Nick Dudkowski. We'll tell you about it when we get back.
We'll be right back.
Before we go back to the Nick Didkowski interview, just a reminder, we need to show your support for the Calvis and Damian New Music Bazaar. We have to have an audience out there who's willing to say, yes, we want to hear this show.
And if you're listening to this on the Internet some weeks or months later, you can still pledge.
802-454-7762 or 802-454-1238. The operators are standing up.
And out of town, the last number is a 6.
So we finally get to hear, that was Spy Boy by Nick Didkowski, who's going through the CDs. He's got a live two live versions of it, the original version, and the music that gets around.
Yes, our, sort of our smoke on the water.
So we were back in the Nick Hospiter, isn't that nice? Douglas Hospiter.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, Prisoner's Dilemma, and you were getting to the point of how it relates.
Right. So I was interested in making a music piece out of this. I wrote to Pauline Oliveros. I told her about the piece. Concept of it. How could I possibly realize it? And she said, great idea, fantastic, just what we need. Write to Larry Polansky, tell him about it. He's, you know.
Did you know Larry yet?
No.
No. Okay.
No. So that's how I met Larry.
And he was still out in the West Coast.
He was at Mills College.
Yeah.
And it was like a really cold night. I had my calling card or whatever, and I called from a payphone on like 21st Street. I don't know why I called him from a payphone, but I just had the urge, you know. I gave him a buzz. We had a really intense conversation for like 5 minutes where I learned everything that I needed to know about what machine I needed to buy, the fact that HMSL, Hierarchical Music Specification right. Language, was a programming language for music that I could construct a Prisoner's Dilemma musically, and he just turned me on to the track, you know, the hardware platform, the software platform, and became very apparent to me in those 5 minutes that there was also a really interesting community of musicians and composers satelliting around HMSL, and that bore out to be absolutely true, because Phil Burke is like one of the smartest, most creative people I ever met in my life. He's a co-author of HMSL, a good friend, met him out when I went out to Mills. Robert Marsagni, who now works for 3DO, he was doing his graduate work at Mills. He's an incredible HMSL hacker. And that kind of got me into the computer music realm. So I bought myself an Amiga 1000, I got myself HMSL, and started to write some really weird little algorithmic computer music pieces that would kind of bleep and blab.
We did a little conversation now and with people about HMSL, but maybe you're the person to ask, what do you have to do when you sit down and work with it? What kind of feel does it have when you use it?
Yeah, you're actually writing program code. It's not like a sequencer. It's not like Jam Factory or Music Mouse or any kind of a pre-canned application where you boot it up, you know, it says like, what key do you want to jam in, you know, dude, and you like click on C minor and you move your mouse around and it goes like, it's like, wow, cool, computer music, you know. It's not a pre-canned application. It's really hard to use. You got to learn how to program in Forth. So the look and feel is like the look and feel of your word processor. You know, I mean, you're just typing. You're typing for like, you know, 45 minutes before you even, you know, hear anything. But that's extremely rewarding environment because you can basically do anything. You come up with the sickest idea. If you or a friend of yours is a good enough programmer, they'll do it. You know, you can do it. And consequently, no two HMSL pieces sound even remotely the same, because you're not starting on a level high enough to influence musical tastes. It's very non-biased. It's a non-stylistically biased environment for musical experimentation. And so I think it's kind of deliberate that it's kind of a tough environment to work in, or at least it just doesn't come with a lot of bells and whistles. You know, it's got a very, very sophisticated toolbox. It's got a scheduler, something that'll keep track of time, you know, which is basically, if you just think of music as sound over time,
it's
a really nice offhand way to design a programming language that will help you create music. It's just like an object-oriented environment where you can build objects and a scheduler that doesn't really know or care too much about music, and you just write these objects and you kind of toss them into the scheduler, and, you know, stuff comes out. And you're in as much or as little control of that stuff as you want. You can make, you know, very random structures, very fixed structures. It becomes very reflective of you as a programmer and a composer and a musician. So consequently, like on that Hallway CD, listen to any two tracks, it's like, what is, it doesn't smell, taste, feel, sound anything like HMSL, because HMSL is like an enabling technology. It's just an enabling software that that allows you to create, you know, visions of music, forms and structures that otherwise would not be able to, you would not be able to hear.
Is it time for an example of that, or shall we continue on history? Which do you prefer? We can go either way.
Well, what I could do, maybe you want to play something off Hallways.
All right, well, we
well, you've played Meet a Million Times.
We've played almost everything on Hallways, so let's choose two pieces on Hallways to compare, and for those differences. I think what we should do is, we've already played Meet, but let's play it again. Mm-hmm. And then we'll play the hymn tunes one. I can't remember right at the top of my head, but we'll get back to you with the details on that. Excerpt from Meet, we won't play it all, and an excerpt from the hymn tunes.
Great. Thank you.
two completely different tunes played with, created with the same language. That was Gene Parsons' Hymn Tune, Hymn Tunes, and Nick Ditkovsky's excerpt from Meat. Same language. That means you sit down with the with this sort of group of building blocks, tools, you name it, and you twist them and turn them in the way you want.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of interesting because HMSL, it's like a complete development environment for the Amiga. You could write a word processor in it. You don't even have to use the music tools. I mean, that's how general it is. You know, it's a very, very, very incredible, very powerful thing. So, so I was, you know, writing kind of interesting algorithmic, interactive compositions, music that you, you know, actually kind of build a software instrument and you interact with that software instrument.
What does that mean? You sit at a keyboard and adjust it as it's playing?
I can demonstrate a really cool one.
Let's do it. Tell us a little bit about what how it works.
I call it Mandel Music. The user interface is a graphic called the Mandelbrot set.
Yep.
It's a musical. It's not a musical. Okay. It's a mathematical fractal.
Yep.
It's a very beautiful and philosophically intriguing object. It's sort of infinitely expandable. It looks more and more complicated as you get closer and closer. Yet it kind of looks like the overall structure again as you magnify it. You get this kind of self-replication.
Yeah.
It's a very intriguing, beautiful thing. And what I did was I mapped the image, every point on the image, and the behavior of that point onto a musical process. So what actually graphs it is mathematical behavior. Every point has its particular color due to the mathematical behavior that that point represents. And by taking that mathematical behavior and mapping it onto pitch, duration, and loudness, you can actually play the point. And by playing it, you also reveal to yourself a lot about how the Mandelbrot set kind of behaves.
What's the interactivity involved?
You choose where to click.
Ah!
And so not only is your that's how you play it.
Okay.
Pianos you hit with a finger, you hit with a mouse.
Uh-huh.
It's very interesting because the music that results is informed not only by what you're hearing. You know, when you play an instrument and you're improvising, you're principally informed by the music that you are creating. You're listening very much. But here you're as informed by the music that's coming out as the graphics that you're designing. So it's kind of interesting.
Let's
interactive
thing.
Sounds
really interesting.
It's going to take me a minute.
Take a little minute, so we'll take a pause here. Okay, we're back in that infinitely small pause with Nick Ditkovsky is going to demonstrate the Mandelbrot. So walk us through. We're going to pull our mics down, so just leave the mic on you,
mm-hmm.
and you give us a run through, and then we'll just listen to it after you've given us a pretty good description.
Well, I'm looking at the computer screen, which has an image of the full Mandelbrot set on it, and this is a mathematical graph split into... Every point on the screen is basically split into two kinds of behaviors. Points that blow up to infinity under a certain mathematical process, and points that will never blow up to infinity. And the reason they may not blow up is either because they kind of vortex into a single point and never escape, or they oscillate forever. And so you'll hear that kind of behavior. For example, I'm going to click on a point that's inside the Mandelbrot set, and we'll hear it kind of spiral into a single point, never to escape. Here's this kind of sister point. Here's a few that escape. It's off the screen. The trail just shut off the screen. And these nice, gentle little... worked out one a while to escape, but it finally did. So, and now I can set up sort of an ostinato pattern by clicking on points that just oscillate forever and will never escape. All the points that are black are inside the Mandelbrot set. They will never escape. They never escape for a number of reasons. They either go into a single point, like that one did, or they oscillate in some kind of a pattern that can't escape from. Get this little groove started. Could hear like this kind of static, kind of clunky ostinato thing happening. Those are points that are oscillating. Some of them oscillate in patterns of three, some in patterns of five, some in patterns of two. So you get this incredible insight into the complexity of what this graphic is and what the mathematical behavior behind this thing is, and you get to play it. You know, it's kind of fun. So this is a software instrument.
Okay, the radio audience obviously can't see it. So to describe the pattern on the screen is...
It's a Klingon warbird.
Very well done. A Klingon warbird with... That's kind of bloated a little bit.
It is bloated a little bit.
Klingon warbird.
That's
yes.
The cloaking device
yes.
That we see.
Yes, indeed.
Well done. Well
excellent.
Done.
So you're going to take it to the next step now. We're going to hear a complete kind of interaction with this.
Oh, you want me to do a little piece?
Let's do a piece.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to pull all the mics down and we'll just listen.
I'll do like a two-minute piece.
Here we go.
Nick Didkovsky, improvisation on the Mandelbrot set. So there.
Didn't sound like a mandolin too much, though. The high one did, but
it's a warbird mandolin.
Oh,
as you
yes,
suggested.
Of course.
We'll conclude our interview with Nick Didkovsky next week here on the Calvus and Damian New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield. Today is the first of 2 weeks of us asking you, listener, listener, let's make it plural. I'm sure there are two by now.
Audience,
for your support for WGDR, for supporting the Calvus and Damien New Music Bazaar. Let's tell you a little about the bazaar for some of you who listen only occasionally. This interview with Nick Didkovsky is our 60th interview of a composer in the past 2 years.
Oh, I thought all on one day. I was trying to recall the first 59 this afternoon, but I was unable to.
Ah, we have still to broadcast interviews with another couple dozen composers. John Oswald at the end of May, Elma Miller in June, Johann van Kraai in June, and James Tenney and Michael Turkey in July, Chris Konigsberg and Allison Cameron in August, Tom Hamilton and David Behrman in September, Peter Van Riper and Laurie Spiegel in October, Bill Gilliam, Jeff Harrington and Joseph Celli in November, Stephen Parkinson and Martin Arnold in December, and then we're already planned through next year, Arthur Sauer and Johann van Kraai again in January, Ann Southam and Henning Berg in February, Kalliopi Tsupaki and Robert Platz in March. That's Robert H.P. Platz.
I see.
Just
yes,
to make that clear. The show is an experiment, and the experiment continues in its third year next week. It also has a large website, which has become a switchboard for composers around the world. All of this is supported by the kindness and visions of WGDR. So it's really important that if you are listening to our show and have found any of these things to be interesting, that you give us a call at 454-7762 or 454-1238 to give us a pledge for this radio station. The show is also being broadcast now on WOMR out there near Cape Cod. Not the entire show, but individual shows. We've had our first five or six broadcasts there. Also, this happens because of your support. And live concerts. We've had live concerts here, incredible ones. Fred Ho, whose LP, A Song for Manong, you can get for a pledge. He gave a live concert along with Scott M.X. Turner. Rip Keller gave a live concert here at the station. The avant-garde legend Pauline Oliveros gave a live concert here on our show. And certainly those of you who tuned in a couple of months ago heard a 40-piece band and chorus playing a complete opera, 2.5-hour opera here on the Calvus and Damien New Music Bazaar. You can help us continue that by showing that we, in fact, do have a listening audience here, listening to the show, not just on the Internet, but actually right here in central Vermont. Give us a call at 454-7762 or 454-1238. And in our continuing tradition of doing new stuff, we are going to give the world premiere, something that is not unusual on our show. We've given a number of world premieres and another world premiere. Nick Didkovsky will appear Monday at the Festival International de Musique Actuelle in Victoriaville, east of Montreal. And he will be premiering with a Sirius String Quartet and Dr. Nerve, his new piece for String Quartet and Dr. Nerve, the rock computer-generated rock band. He provided us with the opportunity to let you hear his own version of that.
Although he didn't know that we would be premiering it ahead of his premiere.
Yes, he did, actually. Yes, we talked to him about that, and he said, in fact,
He was not coherent when he told us that, so I think that it's all right. I mean, what
you don't think he was hungry, but we were hungrier, and we didn't even get to eat. Anyway, we will play for you now the actual computer rendition of the incomplete, at the time he was still finishing up the last bit, string quartet and rock band piece at the time unnamed, which will be premiered Monday at the Festival de Musique Actuelle in Victoriaville. The only place in the world you can hear this piece is right here on the Calvus and Damien New Music Bazaar.
Otherwise, it will be tomorrow night, or Monday night. It will be performed by a Sirius String Quartet, and this is not a Sirius performance.
Definitely not a Sirius performance. Here it is, music by Nick Didkovsky, performed by his computer, as playing both string quartet and rock band.
Oh, I see.
Yes. And there'll be some pauses in there where there's some incomplete sections, and we'll move through them quickly. But this is the place to hear it, at the Calvus and Damian New Music Bazaar, or WGDR, 454-7762, 454-1238. Please let us hear from you.
We'll be right back.
it is. Music by Nick Didkovsky. That's the sketch, the complete sketch for the piece for string quartet and rock band.
It's too short. There should be more.
There is more.
A lot more.
There's some more which he apparently has completed since then to finish the piece off. That'll be performed Monday night at 7 o'clock at the Victoria New Music Festival. Victoria, did I say Victoria or Victoriaville? Victoriaville New Music Festival.
Yeah, this is a recurring festival, is it?
It happens every year. Sometimes the acts are a bit on the odd side, and sometimes they're a bit on the very odd side. Yesterday, Phil Minton, who we heard in Amsterdam, and who we played on one of our interview shows with, what was her name? Oliver, Mary Oliver. Yes, she played with the Phil Minton group, and so he played there yesterday. Today, William Parker, interesting character. William Parker is playing actually right now. Started at 3 o'clock the William Parker concert, and then there's more tomorrow. Not to be missed, I would think, at 5 p.m. is Dagmar Krause. And then Universe Zero, we're about to hear some Universe Zero in just a bit, not just right this moment, but a little bit later. We'll be playing tomorrow night at 8. And then certainly not to be missed, definitely not to be missed, Dr. Nerve, Nick Didkovsky and Dr. Nerve, 7 p.m. Monday at the Victoriaville Festival.
But that is then, and this is now.
And we've got what?
What do we have? We have questions. Oh, we have music to play as soon as we invite you to call in and pledge your support to this program and others like it or unlike it, as if there are any like it, at 454-1238 or 454-7762, which still, after all these years, spells glip-sob. But now let's turn to another one of these crossover gents, name of Fred Frith, and this is from his Gravity LP, an ancient LP, or at least ancient in the term of digital recordings, and this is, what is this? I can't remember what.
A career in real estate. On our Pop Rocks Pox show, number one.
Thank you.
Yeah, these guys, Universe Zero, have been around for quite a while. They're Belgian, for crying out loud.
Yeah,
and they
Belgian.
Will be playing in another French-speaking enclave.
Yes, at 8 o'clock tomorrow night at the Victoriaville New Music Festival in Victoriaville, Quebec. And if you need information about that, it's 819-752-7912. Once more, if you want to call them, that's 819-752-7912. That's the Victoriaville Festival going on this weekend in Quebec. Okay,
and
what
before
else?
This?
Oh, yes, we need to go through what we heard. Before this was Henry Cow playing Half the Sky from their Western Culture LP. And before that, indeed, Henry Kaiser, another classic from a Metal Language LP, It's a Wonderful Life, that was Let's Drink 100% Healthy Milk and Study Hard. And finally, opening this set, Fred Frith, A Career in Real Estate from Gravity. So, well, gosh, 454-7762, 454-1238 for your pledging to the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar. We got to get out of here for this week for show number 104. We'll be back next week beginning year number 3 of the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar. And in order to sort of close out this second year, we can play a classic tune played in a classic rendition.
Yes, how so?
This is, you recognize the tune, and it's the Kronos String Quartet. And this is actually one of the encore pieces that everybody just... All them good yuppie audiences just jump up and down and yell and scream when they heard them play this first time.
That's right, as well they should. And you can run up and down and jump up and scream too, as long as you call us with your pledge 1-2-3-8-4-5-4-7-7-6-2-4-5-4.
That's area code 802 if you're on the internet listening to the show. 802-454-7762. Let that run right to us. And here it is. We're got to get out of here. See you next week at this time. We'll tell you more. We'll have the second part of the interview with Nick Didkowski. We got to talk fast. And
that's it.
a production of Multimedia.